It is Friday, and it is Catholic Answers Live, but it is not Cy Kellett. Cy is unfortunately out sick today. I am your fill-in host today. I am Catholic apologist and speaker Trent Horn. It feels like, I don't know about you, but everybody I hear is getting sick. I think it's just that time of year we're all bundled up, we're all stressed about the holidays, and the germs come after us with a vengeance. So I know people near and dear to me aren't feeling well, and poor Mr. Cy Kellett isn't feeling well. Do pray for him that he'll make a speedy recovery to be here, because he sure knows how to host this show far better than I do. I will do my best. But guess what? I do not have to do a lot of work here to be the host today, because you have got some terrific guests for 2 hours of Catholic Answers Live today. Our second guest is a man who needs no introduction, but I will give him one anyways. He is the director of apologetics here at Catholic Answers. He is one of the world's best Catholic apologists, and I'm not just saying that because he's my boss, but he is my boss. He is Mr. Tim Staples, who's going to be here for an open forum. So any questions you have about the Catholic faith, or possibly any questions you have in general, Tim is more than happy to answer that. That's going to be hour two here on Catholic Answers Live. And our first hour today, we're going to be going to the movies. You remember that old song? Let's all go to the lobby. Well, let's all go to Catholic Answers Live to hear about the movies. We're going to hear about that today. Our guest is Deacon Stephen Gradonis. He is a film critic for the National Catholic Register, a member of the New York Film Critics Circle, as it is a deacon at the Catholic Archdiocese of New York. He has degrees in media arts, theology, and religious studies. So he is an excellent guest to have on to talk about what happens when faith meets film. And there's some big movies coming out, because obviously it's the Christmas season. That's when studios drop some of their biggest films. If you're like me on Christmas, you probably, you open the presents, you spend time with family, then it's about 1 o'clock, and you're like, all right, what do we do for the rest of the day? Everything is closed. And you end up probably going to the movies. I used to work at the movies, and Christmas and Thanksgiving were some of our busiest days. So let's hear a little bit more about some of the movies that are out this weekend and how our faith intersects with them and what we should think about them. Steve, are you there with us? Thanks for being here.
Trent, it's good to be here with you from the Archdiocese of Newark.
Oh, did I say New York? I'm sure that there are people there who could take quite offense to that. So, but they do actually sound pretty similar. So the Archdiocese of Newark, New Jersey.
Yes, we have a Penn Station in New York and a Penn Station in Newark. It's not confusing at all.
No, I'm sure it isn't at all. Well, thanks so much for being here, and I'm really excited because we've got some great films to bring up to talk about, but also we were willing to take your calls when it comes to films. You have questions about films that are out, or what happens when faith and film and Hollywood collide? How can Christians live out their faith in Hollywood that's often very antithetical to our faith? Be sure to call in, and we're happy to take your questions on that. The number is 888-318-7884. I was nervous as I walked in the studio. I was like, what's the number again? Fortunately, it's right in front of me. 888-318-7884. So Steve, let's get right down to it. Let's talk about probably the biggest movie that is opening this weekend. Actually, I mean, just open in select theaters now. It's out now. And that would be Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. So people have said, oh, this is Episode 9. It's the last Star Wars movie. Is there ever really a last Star Wars movie?
Probably not. This is the last film they're telling us. It's the last film in what they're calling the Skywalker saga. So the 9 numbered Star Wars films to date all turn out to be one story, fundamentally about one family, that started chronologically in our universe with the first Star Wars 42 years ago, back in 1977. Mm-hmm. But when you put the films in their own chronological order, it starts with Episode 1 and the youth of Anakin Skywalker, who grows up to be Darth Vader. He has a son named Luke Skywalker. And now it's the story of the last Skywalker and a heroine whose origins I'm not going to reveal, because you have to see the movie.
I have heard that this is a difficult movie to review because critics are obliged, sometimes professionally, but also as a courtesy, to not put out spoilers for films, especially when they haven't been released yet. This one seems, I've noticed other reviewers have had a difficult time, not difficult, but it's hard for them to explain the film without getting into spoiler territory. Is that accurate?
I I consider myself a pretty spoiler-averse critic, but I've never had a hard time talking about what a movie is about thematically. It doesn't usually conflict with avoiding talking about the actually spoilery things that happen in the movie. In this case, it's pretty familiar territory because our writer-director, J.J. Abrams, who also did the first film in this new Disney sequel trilogy. This is a trilogy of trilogies, the original trilogy, the prequel trilogy, and now right. The sequel trilogy. J.J. Abrams, who did episode 7, The Force Awakens, is back for episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. It's a bit of a sandwich because in between we had Rian Johnson, the writer-director of Knives Out, which is in theaters right now, who did The Last Jedi. And that was tonally very different from the other two. A lot of fans who really liked The Force Awakens because it kind of returned them to the feel of the original trilogy after the prequels.
Which was a criticism of the prequels, that it's like, this doesn't feel like right. Star Wars to me.
That's right. And so Abrams really understood his mission in The Force Awakens to give the fans that sense of that original series that they had lost. And he probably, in my opinion, he went overboard. It was a little too derivative. It was a little too much just a remake of the first film.
Right.
Johnson felt that a franchise, a mythology, needs to change and to grow, to move forward. And there's something to be said for that. I mean, these films, the original films, they're part of our cultural DNA. They have a mythic role in American culture. And part of that is because of the way that George Lucas reinvented the story with each new movie. You know, that moment in 1980 when Darth Vader said, "No, Luke, I am your father."
Hey, whoa. So spoiler alert, everybody. Spoiler alert.
All of America collectively gasped. You know, that's the kind. And then again, 3 years later, you take this villainous character, Darth Vader. He's like the incarnation of evil. He's like the Wicked Witch of the West. And
right.
And what does Lucas do? He doesn't have Luke beat him in a sword fight. He has Luke losing to the Emperor, but winning through the power of love, through the father-son bond, which is stronger than the dark side. These are the kinds of bold reconfiguring of the story that you don't get when the plot emerges from a committee, which,
right.
considering that Star Wars is being made by Disney, I imagine there are a lot of committee meetings.
And so do you get that feeling then when you compare the different trilogies? We look at all three, the very original, the prequels, which are almost a hybrid committee, but George Lucas still had almost unilateral control over them. And then this final trilogy, which when it's designed by committee, it makes me think of that old adage that a camel is a horse that was designed by a committee, that when you get a bunch of people together, you can't not necessarily get the best product you wanted out of it.
I think that's really true. And it's certainly the case that the latter films are more fun to watch than the prequel trilogy, like on a scene by scene basis. When you sit down, if you happen to turn on the TV and part of The Force Awakens is on or part of The Last Jedi, it's going to be more fun to watch and less painful in some ways than watching the prequels. But the prequels at least had a kind of artistic integrity. They hold together. They're all the product fundamentally of one man's vision.
Right.
And even though they're kind of poorly constructed, you can see what he's doing. With these films, there's this kind of narrative tug of war between nostalgia and revisionism that prevents the Rise of Skywalker from the possibility of achieving real greatness, because it spends half the time undoing the previous film's undoing of what the film before that did.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's another common criticism I've heard, is that it's very rushed in what it tries to achieve. Before we go to a break here, let me just ask you, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about the deeper religious mythos and subtext related to Star Wars, because I think that it touches people and reaches them in a very deep way, almost as faith does, to something primordial within us that we're called to. And I want to talk about that when we come back. But before we go
Absolutely.
To a break, a very quick one I think is important. Is there anything in the film that parents should be aware of that you can tell us without getting too spoilery?
Yes. You know, all of these films have standard sci-fi combat, violence, menace, maybe some images that would be very scary to young children. Parents should know in particular, there's a fleeting scene at the end of this movie. It's a celebratory scene. Everybody's coming together and hugging each other. And if you're watching closely, you will notice two women in the background of the scene coming together and they kiss on the lips. And, you know, in 2019, Disney feels that they have to put in something like that, this same-sex kiss. But they also want to make it as painless as possible because they want to sell this movie to everyone.
Trying to make everyone happy, yeah.
And what happens when you try to make everyone happy very often is you wind up making nobody happy.
That's kind of a theme for this entire... I've also seen other reviewers. That's kind of a theme for this movie as a whole, trying to make everyone happy and... You can't make everyone happy. Though I will say in episode 4, or Star Wars, I should say the first Star Wars, I think at the end of that film in the congratulatory scene, a brother and sister kiss. But they don't know their brother and sister at the time. So, right, when, you know, Luke and Leia. I think actually in the film, Mark Hamill gaffes and he says, like, Carrie or something. So, portrayed by actress Carrie Fisher. All right, well, let's we'll be back then in a short while to talk more about Star Wars. We got one caller on the line here. Hopefully others will join us. 318-888-7884. No, is that the number? Yeah. 888-318-7884. I knew, Nick. I knew I had the number. I haven't been doing this forever, but we'll give it our best shot here. But before we go to our break, I must tell you that we have our Christmas sale. What have I got here? Man, Cy is so much smoother at this than me. Cy, why'd you have to go and get sick on me? Did you know that shop.catholic.com has hundreds of downloadable gifts? You can sign up instantly there for our new School of Apologetics. Don't want to miss that. We got a wonderful course on beginner apologetics from Jimmy Akin. And for the first time ever, we have digital gift certificates for the Catholic Answers online shop. So a great gift that you can give to a loved one is the gift of Catholic Answers itself. We have books, CDs, downloadable digital products, the School of Apologetics, magazines, ebooks, so many wonderful things. Do visit us today at shop.catholic.com. Hurry, you may not be able to get a physical package before Christmas, but a lot of digital gifts you can send to your loved ones. There is still time. Go to shop.catholic.com.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Hi, I'm Brian Patrick. Join me, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and Father Thomas Petrie for The Church Alive.
It's not a happy time at the moment in Washington and for the people who go to the Basilica.
Father, you mentioned a forensic investigation. Define forensic in this context.
I think it simply means they're going to be looking if there's any victims who have not come forward, if there's any substance to the allegations.
In other words, we're really digging down into what could be the allegations.
Yes. The Church Alive, tomorrow, 7 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
It is Catholic Answers Live. I am doing my best to be in my element, but I'm not in my element because your host with the most, Mr. Cy Kellett, is out sick. Filling in for him today is me, Catholic Answers staff apologist Trent Horn. I'm more at ease on my own podcast. If you want to listen there, I promise a bit more at ease in my own element at TrentHornPodcast.com. Be sure to go check out some of my work there at TrentHornPodcast.com. If you like hearing about culture, faith, and how to explain and defend your Catholic faith, you'll definitely want to go and check that out at TrentHornPodcast.com. Council of Trent, also available for free on iTunes, Google Play, and other places where podcasts are available. We're coming back with Deacon Steve Gradonis talking to us about reviewing films. We're talking about Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, and we have a caller on the line. We have Jordan from New Jersey. Jordan, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Now, Jordan, Steve is a deacon in Newark. Are you anywhere? Jersey's kind of a small state. Are you near Newark?
About 45 minutes.
Okay, so you're actually pretty nearby our guest today. So what is your question for Steve?
My question is it complicated to put faith into a movie?
Oh, did you say faith? F-A-I-T-H?
Faith,
yes.
Religious
yes.
faith?
Yes, exactly.
So, okay. That's a very interesting question. It's certainly very easy to portray faith and religious themes badly in movies. If a filmmaker wants to get their religious beliefs across, and they put the things that they believe on the lips of their characters, you can get what's sometimes called the Mary Sue effect, where the character winds up becoming a spokesperson for the filmmaker. It's very easy, I think, particularly for Christian filmmakers, to use film in a way to kind of reinforce the messages that their believing audience wants to hear, and you get something that's more like propaganda than like cinema. I think religious cinema is at its best when, and I think all art in general is at its best when the artist is straining for something which is in some way beyond them. That's really where art comes into play. Art comes into play when you sense that there's some larger reality that you haven't fully got a handle on. And that happens in two ways. Sometimes you get some of the best movies about faith by filmmakers who are not themselves believers, like Robert Bolt writing the screenplay and the stage play for A Man for All Seasons. And there are many other examples, but you do see filmmakers of faith, and we're going to talk about one of them in this segment. Terrence Malick is a practicing Episcopalian filmmaker who is also an absolutely masterful visual artist. He's revered in Hollywood and revered by cinephiles. And he has just made one of the most astounding films about faith that I've ever seen. And it's in theaters right now. If you get a chance to see it on the big screen, absolutely do. The movie is called A Hidden Life, and it is about the life and death of Blessed Franz Jägerstätter, a martyr of the Nazi regime in 1943, beatified by Pope Benedict in 2007, who declared him a martyr. What Malick does is to portray faith as a struggle between what Jägerstätter knows is right and his very human desire not to be separated from his wife and family, not to die. This is not something that he seeks. It's something that is very difficult for him. But at the same time, it's that sacrifice and that suffering is part of his relationship with God. And by taking seriously his love for his wife and portraying that in a very cinematic way, and then portraying in a very cinematic way the difficulty of his sacrifice and of his passion, I think that faith is realized on the screen in a way that is absolutely transcendent. So it is possible, but yes, it is difficult.
Is that a helpful answer, Jordan? I don't think we have Jordan on the line anymore, but I thought it was a helpful answer. Thank you so much, Steve. And I'm glad you brought up A Hidden Life. I want to talk about that a little more here before we go to our next break. But let's tie a bow then, since we're talking about faith in film, and we've talked about Star Wars, it's a cultural phenomena. And I think the reason it's a phenomena is because, as I mentioned before the break, it really impacts something kind of deep, or a good word to use might be archetypal, within each of us. And I think that can have a religious subtext to it that we can draw from. Would you agree with that?
I do. George Lucas was an indifferent craftsman in certain ways. He's never going to be renowned for his dialogue, and the acting in his films is generally not of the first rank.
I hate sand. It's coarse. It gets everywhere.
But I mean, he was a magnificent technologist. He figured out new ways of doing things,
right,
that had never been seen before. But then also he deepened it with the kinds of stories that he was interested in. He loved J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. He loved T.H. White's The Once and Future King. He drew on Akira Kurosawa and World War I and World War II movies. He drew on all kinds of sources, and he synthesized them into this mythology of the Force, which has aspects of Christianity and Buddhism. And the great thing about it is that it's a kind of open-ended metaphor that you can read and interpret in different ways. But he was sufficiently influenced by Christianity in these stories to end the saga, as I think we might have said before the break, with the triumph of good over evil, not through might, but through the power of love, through redemption. There's redemption. There is goodness that comes out of turning away from evil. That's something that I think has been lost in these later films. As the saga has developed, you come to a moment in The Rise of Skywalker, this ninth film, where you realize that all nine of these films, the whole history, the whole fate of the universe has basically been in the hands of one family. Just a few members of one family are controlling everything for everybody. And even though they've made it a much larger cast with, you know, diverse characters and so forth, all of that becomes completely irrelevant when it comes down to, you know, who is going to have the most awesome moment in the final showdown. And I think that becomes, I referred to this as shrinking world syndrome in the past, that as a story progresses, the universe gets bigger, but the actual universe gets smaller, the universe that matters, because characters and things become more and more connected. And when you extend a story across this many chapters, I think it starts to become a moral problem. You know, that the lives and the sacrifice and all of the things that all these other characters are doing, ultimately none of that really matters. It's going to come down to this one moment, and that to me is a problem.
Yeah, I think also when we look at this, I like the point that you raised about how in cinema we've lost this idea, and as Christian filmmakers or Christians in art, promoting the idea of conquering evil, not necessarily through violence, though sometimes violence is necessary to do that, justified violence, but through the power of love and through sacrifice. I mean, when you go back to the original trilogy, of the three, I mean, for most people, Return of the Jedi is they like it, but it's their least favorite because it's, you know, a bunch of teddy bears bringing down stormtroopers. But that final scene where you would expect just in modern films, the hero would just cut down the villains and there's an explosion and it's done, that the great climax is when the incarnation of evil, as you described him, Darth Vader, sees that he does not have to be that anymore as his son is being tortured and is about to be murdered in front of him. And that the reason he's changing is because of his son's faith in him, that he's not this pure incarnation of evil, that goodness is still there. And that reaches to people. I mean, if you look at the whole Star Wars mythos, I think what people like about it is it's Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. And everybody wants to be the hero that goes on that journey. And the most successful films have been ones, especially that appeal to a wide audience, tap into that, whether it's Indiana Jones or you go to even other films, like even Titanic almost kind of follow that same arc. Would you agree
and
with that?
Notice that Indiana Jones in particular, like Luke Skywalker at the end of Return of the Jedi, does not win through brute force or through awesomeness. Indiana Jones at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, just like Luke Skywalker at the end of Return of the Jedi, is helpless. He's tied up. He can't do anything.
Right.
It's up to the power of God to end the Nazi threat, to the God of the Jews versus the ultimate anti-Semitic villains, the Nazis.
Right.
And even in the first Star Wars movie, although it's true that Luke blows up the Death Star by being a hero who uses the Force and has a moment of awesomeness, it's also the self-destructive power of evil. Evil destroys itself because the Empire is this military-industrial complex that worships power and can't imagine one person as a significant threat. It worships the collective and it ignores the individual. And that's a conceit. But there is something meaningful in there about a particular kind of evil and the way that it can self-destruct.
Your overconfidence is your weakness. Your faith in your friends is yours. Except the faith is well put, and it's able to defeat the Empire's overconfidence. And since we're talking about Star Wars, I managed to get Star Wars impersonation in there. Maybe we'll have a few others. You never know. Well, great. So Star Wars Rise of Skywalker is out in theaters. Hidden Life sounds wonderful, though. It probably has a much more limited release. Where can people go and see A Hidden Life? Because it sounds like a fascinating story for people to hear about, especially people of faith.
Yes, it is opening in the Rise of Skywalker is opening the widest possible opening. You can see it absolutely everywhere. Wherever you live, you can see the Rise of Skywalker. You're going to have to look for A Hidden Life. If you get a chance to see it on the big screen, it is a 3-hour movie, but the visual artistry will reward you. And it doesn't feel like 3 hours. It feels while you're watching it, almost as if you're in a trance, like time doesn't matter. That's the power of Malick's visual artistry.
The power, indeed, the power to show truth and even the ultimate truth through film. We'll be talking more about that when we come back with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about films and faith. If you want to call in and talk about that, 888-318-7884. We will be back right after a short break of messages for you. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Trevor Williams from the Pittsburgh Pirates, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our On Fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Coming up tomorrow on More to Life, who can you trust?
Struggling with questions of trust? We're here to help.
That's tomorrow on More to Life, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 Central on EWTN Radio.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Filling in today for host Cy Kellett is myself, Trent Horn, apologist and speaker here at Catholic Answers. We're talking with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, who is a film critic for the National Catholic Register and other media outlets, talking about faith, film, new movies that are opening, where they intersect with our faith, and what you should know about them. If you have questions about any of that, feel free to call us at 888-318-7884. Steve, the next film that I want to talk about is one that's been out for a little while now. It might still be in some theaters. I saw it over Thanksgiving, and that is A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. It's a biopic film about Mr. Rogers. And so with Tom Hanks portraying Mr. Rogers, and I will say that Tom Hanks should probably be put in the Smithsonian. Just put him there right now. That he is a national treasure that should be there on a little thing next to the, you know, Wilbur and Wright's airplane, you know. So I liked it. And of course, this movie was made for someone especially like my age is especially one of the target age demographics, millennial, late millennial, because we grew up on Mr. Rogers and Gen X to some extent, I would say. Well, actually, no, Mr. Rogers has been going for quite a long time. So I remember growing up on it. And so when I saw this film, I went with my wife. I actually, you know, don't go to the movies that often. And so I went with her and we saw it. And if I had allowed myself, I probably would have cried like a baby in this film. I got misty and it spoke to me. And I want to get your thoughts on the film, because this is one where faith really intersects in ways people might not expect. That the movie is not what you'd expect. I say it's a biopic, but most biopics feel very biographical. Like if you saw the biopic about Ray Charles, for example, or other biopics in film, it starts at the beginning of their life and then goes through it to see how they progressed as a human being and the story of their life. This film felt more like an episode of the Mr. Rogers television show that was written for me as an adult, and I needed to hear its message, and a lot of people needed to hear its message. And that's what I think made it very powerful. So take it away, your thoughts.
Yeah, and you could say, and I think it has been said and should be said, that Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is not really a biopic at all. For that reason, it's not centered on Mr. Rogers. It's centered on this journalist, Lloyd Vogel, who is based on or inspired by a real life journalist who did a profile of Mr. Rogers back in 1998 for Esquire magazine. It was an encounter that did not go the way that he thought, and it wound up becoming an enduring friendship. And so it's about the transformation that occurs in this character, Lloyd Vogel's life, as a result of his encounter with Mr. Rogers. But you're absolutely right. Right in the beginning, when the movie starts, if you're watching a recreation of the opening of every episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But then something happens right in the beginning as Mr. Rogers is addressing the camera, played by Tom Hanks, in the way that he did. There's a door that opens, and suddenly you're not in the TV show anymore. You are in a world in which Mr. Rogers is speaking to you, the grown-up, about the trauma in your life and about the people that you might have a hard time forgiving. And that is – it's a very clever narrative choice, and it's a good way of drawing you into the reality of what made Mr. Rogers such a lasting force in people's lives, because viewers did feel that sense of connection with him, that he was speaking to me, you know, when I was a kid watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. There's a line in the film where Rogers says to Vogel, do you know what's the most important thing to me right now? Talking to Lloyd Vogel, that sense of generosity,
it's essentially really, he really cares, and it's something that many adults, I think, would want to quickly dismiss as cynical in a cynical way, because they can't expect that people could ever really value another human being in this way. I think another great choice that was made with the film was, it's interesting, is that I'm sure other actors probably could have gotten Mr. Rogers' portrayal like completely on point. Like you get an actor no one's ever heard of who is just perfect at replicating Mr. Rogers. But I think the choice of Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers fit better, even if he doesn't get all the, and he does a great job acting. He does a good job being Mr. Rogers, just like he did a good job being Walt Disney. But he doesn't try to ape or exactly duplicate the person. He allows his own natural charisma to come through. That many people, how they identify with Mr. Rogers, they have that same sense of warmth and trust in an actor like Tom Hanks, and so it works well for the role.
I like what A.R. Scott of the New York Times said about Mr. Rogers being a feline presence and Tom Hanks being a canine presence. He's like a big friendly Labrador. And to try to become Mr. Rogers really does play against type for him. But he does have that sense of kindness and genuineness and decency. You believe that that's really who he is, that he's not like a jerk who plays nice guys really well. and that's important. important because we all know that Mr. Rogers was that genuine person, that he didn't play, and this is something that comes out of the movie, he didn't play a character on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. That's who he was. He had that sense of integrity, which I think is a virtue that's so often underappreciated. You know, people think of integrity as just being like honesty or trustworthiness. But if you think about the way that we use the word integrity in non-moral senses, like right. We talk about structural integrity, mm-hmm. or in medicine, they talk about skin integrity. What integrity is the virtue that holds together all the different parts of something and make it one thing. Like when I go to work, I become a different social self than I am at home. You know, I have my work self and my home self and my church self. I have different mannerisms and different ways of speaking to different people. But if I'm the same moral person in all of those contexts, where I don't give myself permission to do something in one context that I would never dream of doing in another.
Right.
That's what the virtue of integrity is. And that's what Mr. Rogers had.
And what animates Mr. Rogers, and this comes through in the film, not in a heavy-handed way, which is helpful. And I think a way of film that we talked earlier about how sometimes, you know, if a Christian made a film, they'll lay it on too heavy, the message they want to put forward. I think there was just the right amount to show that what gave Mr. Rogers his integrity was his faith, that he was an ordained Presbyterian minister. He prays for people by name. He reads scripture. So this is a wonderful film to show an example of faith. How do you see faith intersecting with this particular film?
I think that you're right that the movie honors Mr. Rogers' faith, his belief in God, his prayer, as integral to who he is. I think it's interesting if you read the original profile in Esquire. You can Google it. Mm-hmm. Can You Say Hero is the name of the profile.
Right.
That prayer is an even bigger part of that story. And Mr. Rogers actually leads the journalist in praying himself. That's kind of the climax of the piece is that he actually prays. And that doesn't happen here in this movie. I wish that it had.
Yeah.
I think the movie could have made an even more countercultural statement about faith and prayer than it does. But I do appreciate it for what it is. And it's a great little film.
Well, do you think that I know some people have been critical and of Mr. Rogers now that ever since this film and the there was another more kind of a straight documentary about Mr. Rogers that came out a few years ago that some
Won't You Be My Neighbor.
That's right. Yeah. Won't You Be My Neighbor.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And it's another great one. But the criticism is that we shouldn't reduce Christianity to a kind of Mr. Rogers kindness and that's it. And I think that that's fair in the sense that if you think that kindness is a sufficient condition for living out our faith, you're right. That's correct. We can't stop there. But I think when people make this criticism, they forget that it's a vitally necessary condition, that when we live in such a polarized and mean age, it's something we're sorely lacking. So what do you think?
C.S. Lewis talks about how the devil always sends errors into the world in equal and opposite pairs. And he relies on our disdain for one to cause us to fall toward the other. Mm. So there is, when you look at the person of Christ, there is in Christ both meekness and gentleness and also ferocity and strength. Mm-hmm. So many people in our age are addicted to fierceness that they become contemptible of gentleness and of kindness. And Mr. Rogers, for some people, actually becomes a symbol of something that we should actively avoid. Mm-hmm. I heard someone say, a friend of mine on Twitter, that Jesus was gentle when he had to be and fierce when he had to be. And I would put it a little differently. I would say that Jesus was fierce when he had to be and gentle when he didn't. In other words, gentleness is the default and fierceness
right.
should be the exception.
Right.
That I think is the counter cultural message of Mr. Rogers, that gentleness, kindness is that's the way that we should treat people by default. But we
right.
there is such an anger in the world today. That's hard for people to see.
And I think what's helpful with the film and with the example of Mr. Rogers to imitate Christ, that our kindness towards others, some people think kindness means we never challenge other people. And in the film, Mr. Rogers gently challenges the main character to restore an important and broken relationship in his life. And even you go look at the old episodes of Mr. Rogers, that he challenged his childhood, the children watching, to be able to confront difficult things in their lives, their emotions, trauma, other things like that. And so I think that it's a healthy dose of kindness you'll enjoy. If you haven't seen it, bring a box of tissues with you. I thoroughly recommend it. I think Steve does as well. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood may still be playing in Cineplex. So I'm sure it'll be out on streaming and available to rent soon. Now we have another special guest who has joined us here in the studio. She is assistant producer Marie Dixon with a special message for us. Marie?
Hi. Howdy. Happy Friday to everybody. I just wanted to extend an invitation to everyone listening. We're coming up on Christmas here so shortly, which is hard to believe. And I know some of you are still looking for Christmas presents for people. So I just want to invite you on our cruise this spring on the Rhine River. It's going to be amazing. It's in June. It's going to travel from Switzerland to France and Germany, and we're having Archbishop Cordiglione there, and just lately we've gotten Monsignor Eugene Morris to join us, who's
a big hit at the conference.
He's an amazing speaker. If you've never gotten to hear him, look him up. He's fantastic. So he's going to be there as well. It's all inclusive. And we're almost sold out. The entire boat is for Catholic Answers for this cruise, and there are only 11 cabins left. So if you want to come on this amazing trip, which we have, our president, Chris Check, is going to be there, and Cy Kellett, who's not here today, but he will be on the cruise as well. Please go to CatholicAnswersCruise.com. And you can find more details there. So
I'll tell you this, Marie. I was on the previous river cruise on the Danube. We started in Hungary and ended up in Germany. And it was a wonderful experience. One, it was awesome having the boat. It was just Catholic Answers. Like, we've been on cruise ships before. And you got to share it with other people. But we could just relax. It's just us. The whole boat is us. And, we can just do things and have talks and everything. It just feels so Catholic. And number two, I'll tell you what's great about a river cruise. Do you get seasick?
I have gotten seasick before, yes.
I will tell you this. You will not get seasick on a river cruise.
That's very cool. What is the reason for that?
Well, the reason for that is the boat doesn't go up and down in the water like in yes. the ocean. It's basically like driving in a very slow bus.
But on a very beautiful bus a beautiful river.
Yeah. So no.
Yes.
This cruise will feel like being on a bus. No, but it's a bus that has wonderful food. Yeah. It is over 100
and
feet
all,
long.
And all of your drinks are included. Right. Everything's included. And just, even the people who have booked so far and all of the speakers and everybody, it's just such a wonderful group to spend time with on a trip.
And what's great is on the river cruise, you don't spend a lot of time on the boat even. You sleep on the boat and you have the meals there. And since it's going smooth on the river, it doesn't even feel like you're on a boat, so you don't get sick. Then you go on all these excursions, which are included.
Yes.
And so when I was on the Danube cruise, we did bike rides to Austria, go on wine tasting and have time to talk to people about faith and visit wonderful cathedrals and other historic sites where the faith has been present for over 1,000 years. Yeah. You're not going to want to miss it. Give us the address again.
Yep. So just go to CatholicAnswersCruise.com. That's CatholicAnswersCruise.com.
Thank you so much, Marie Dixon.
You're welcome.
And we will be back right after this.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is honored by the church as one of the greatest enemies of clergy sexual abuse.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
In his time, St. Peter Damian fought against the many vices of contemporary clergy, especially sexual abuses among the clergy. In 1051, he wrote the Book of Gomorrah that is still considered essential reading for fighting abuse today. He died in 1072.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
We'll be right back.
are back talking about faith and film. What has hit the multiplex, the cineplex, the theater near you? I am Trent Horn filling in today for Mr. Cy Kellett. My guest is Stephen Gradonis, who is a film critic for the National Catholic Register. We can talk about a lot of films that are out in theaters, but there is another film, or is it a film or a series? Well, I guess we'll find out. Our host knows more about it than I do, that you can catch right from the comfort of your own home. It is available on Netflix, and I think actually in some theaters. And this is one, as Catholics, we're probably going to be very interested in wondering about. And that film is The Two Popes. It is a film dramatizing the relationship between Pope Benedict XVI, Cardinal Ratzinger, and Pope Francis. And so the film was about their relationship at the period at the end of Pope Benedict's papacy. So I don't know a lot more about this film. I've only seen a few trailers here or there. Our guest, Stephen Gradonis, knows a lot more and can walk us through. Tell us a bit more about The Two Popes.
So it is a movie. It is in theaters, but it's also, I think it's on Netflix starting like today. Anyways, it's right around now that you can see it on Netflix. When Pope Francis was elected at the resignation of Pope Benedict, a lot of people looked at him and said, wow, if they ever made a movie about him, you know who they'd have to get to play him? Jonathan Pryce, because there really is a kind of a startling physical resemblance there. And then also, he does a very good job of getting Pope Francis's mannerisms right. Anthony Hopkins, who is just a great actor, has not, in my experience, from the films that I've seen, invested himself heavily in kind of turning like a chameleon into the people that he plays. I loved his C.S. Lewis in Shadowlands back in, I think, 93, but he didn't act or sound like Lewis. And right. he's not very much like Cardinal Ratzinger or Pope Benedict in this film either.
I mean, if you kind of squint, you can see a little bit of a resemblance. It's not like a horrible miscast or anything like that. But Hopkins is, of course, an extremely strong actor. He won an Academy Award for Best Actor in 1992. So, of course, you have someone that even if that, you know, they still bring a certain gravitas to the film. And I'm sure he does that here in The Two Popes.
He does. And of the two of them, I would say that his is the more interesting performance. I have to say, about 30 minutes into it, I didn't know if I was going to be able to finish it. I it absolutely had me. I went out on Twitter and I said, I don't know how much more of this I can take. But it calms down a little bit after that. And in their interactions, although it's, I would say, pretty much completely a slam. Just a total assassination of Benedict.
Really?
Nevertheless, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Basically, the film's thesis is that Benedict represents everything that was wrong with the church of yesterday, and Francis embodies everything that we need from the church of tomorrow. You know, Benedict is the one who's holding the church back, who sees any kind of change as compromise. He's mm-hmm. ultra traditionalist, reactionary guy, and Francis is the voice of reform and conscience and liberation from ossifying traditions, which really does such a disservice to both of these men.
Right.
It's completely false to their personalities, and the movie even just outright fictionalizes on important factual details. Like right for almost 7 minutes in, I almost turned it off because they portray Cardinal Ratzinger at the 2005 conclave after the death of Pope St. John Paul II
right.
as being really kind of ambitious for the papacy, you know, going around kind of working the room and other cardinals are looking at him suspiciously, which anyone who knows the first thing about the man knows that's the total
right.
opposite of the truth. He had wanted to resign from the CDF for years, and John Paul wouldn't let him and
right.
kept burdening him with further. He's an academic at heart. He just wanted to retire and write. And here's the kicker. The screenwriter, who also wrote a stage play called The Pope, based on the same material, Anthony McCartan, wrote a nonfiction book also called The Two Popes. And in his book, he gets it right. He's got a whole chapter on the reluctant Pope, Pope right. Benedict. So the fact that he just completely falsifies the characterization and then goes on to invent this ridiculous conflict between the two of them that dominates the whole first act, where Pope Francis is looking suspiciously at Jorge Bergoglio, Cardinal Bergoglio, the future Pope Francis,
right.
In this meeting in 2003, saying to him, you know, that why are you offering your resignation prematurely before turning 75? You're not ill. This looks to me like a protest, like you're protesting against my conservative papacy, and I won't have any appearance of protest, so I won't let you resign. Which, again, is just totally contrary to the facts. The fact is that when Cardinal Bergoglio was 75
right.
In 2012 when he handed in his resignation, and resignations often sit on the Pope's desk for months with no action. It's just the way that things happen. And again, McCartan gets these facts right in his nonfiction book. So he's doing it on purpose.
That's
but
unfortunate.
Lots of people are going to watch this on Netflix and they're not going to know
sure.
how much it distorts the facts in the service of this thesis of Benedict as the bad conservative Pope rejected by God and Francis as the good progressive Pope chosen by God to lead us into the future.
Who would have ever thought that Hollywood would come up with a vision like that for these popes? Especially, I mean, I would love to play a game with the screenwriters of this film and present them with various papal quotes and say, who do you think said this, Pope Benedict or Pope Francis? Having an abortion is like hiring a hitman. No, that's definitely something Benedict would say. Like, actually, it's Pope Francis. So, and then what's interesting there is you could go back also during Pope Benedict's pontificate that there were people within the church, a very small number, I would say, who were critical of what he was doing, of doing things that they considered to be changes that they didn't agree with and things like that. So it is funny. Do you think that when Hollywood gets in, especially writes films about the faith, if they don't have somebody, quote unquote, on the inside, it's easy for them to fall into these kinds of distortions?
I think that people that are so high up in the public eye that we turn them into symbols and we project our hopes and our fears onto them.
Yeah.
So many people look at someone and, in American politics, it's Donald Trump, it's Hillary Clinton, it's President Obama. Don't worry, I'm not going to get political and tell you what I think. But these figures become symbols of what we hope or what we fear. And it blinds people to the reality of the complicated human beings, because that's not as convenient a symbol for the things that we want to talk about ourselves. And that's really what you have in this movie, is not anything like the real Pope Francis
right.
or Pope Benedict, but you have symbols of two principles in the church that Anthony McCartan wanted to write about.
And so the plot, does it center around then on their relationship shortly after Pope Benedict's resignation and Pope Francis's election? I wasn't clear on that.
Yeah, you might think so. And that was the original impetus, was just the fascination of the idea that you would have a pope and a pope emeritus at the same time. That was what McCartan originally wanted to write about. But instead, he wrote about this conflict in their imaginary relationship beforehand. These conversations during Pope Benedict's papacy, while the future Pope Francis was still a cardinal, conversations that, as far as we know, never happened, or nothing like them ever happened. There's no reason to think, as far as I know, that the two men even really knew each other, let alone that they had these arguments. So, it's pretty much completely invented from start to finish. To me, this is like what Roger Ebert said about the movie Memoirs of a Geisha. He said, I suspect that the more you know about Japan and movies, the less you will enjoy this movie. And I've heard from lots of people who enjoyed The Two Popes. And as far as I'm concerned, that probably means in the vast majority of cases, either they don't know about movies or they don't know about the popes.
Do you think, real quick answer, is it worthwhile for Catholics to see, at least to take with a heavy grain of salt?
You know, I mean, you have to be a glutton for punishment is my bottom line.
Okay. Well, in that case, maybe you'll want something a little bit lighter fare. Maybe something like a Star Wars or, hey, good old beautiful day in the neighborhood. Give you some kindness. We could all use that nowadays. Steve Grudonis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Trent.
Of course, and thank you all for being here. We got another hour coming up. If you have questions about the Catholic faith, call in 888-318-7884. Tim Staples is going to be here for Open Forum. You're not going to want to miss that. Another hour coming up right here on Catholic Answers Live.